WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we talk with writer André Debuse about the accident that changed his life and his writing. Debuse was crippled in 1986 when he was hit by a car while trying to help another motorist. We'll listen back to a 1991 interview with Debuse, then we'll hear a brief talk we recorded yesterday. Debuse has a new collection of short stories called Dancing After Hours. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review. Also, Fritz the Cat, Mr. Natural, and Zap Comics are the creation of the underground comic book artist Art Crumb. The documentary about him, Crumb, showed up on many film critics' 1995 10 Best lists. Crumb just came out on video. We'll hear from the director, Terry Zwigoff. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. André Debuse was a highly regarded but not well-known writer when his life was abruptly changed in 1986 by a car accident. It left him unable to walk again, and he had a hard time getting back to writing. Now he has a new book of short stories. We'll hear from Debuse after book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews his new collection, Dancing After Hours.
In The Colonel's Wife, one of the most compelling stories in André Debuse's new collection, a retired Marine colonel shatters both his legs in a riding accident. For weeks, he lies in a narrow hospital bed placed in the living room of the house he shares with his wife. He watches the snow fall outside the windows and cultivates a stoic attitude toward his pain and helplessness. One afternoon, the wife, who's been out walking, comes in through the front door, and something the colonel sees in her face tells him she's been having an affair. Debuse so precisely renders the terror of abandonment the colonel suffers, it's an effort to read those passages and breathe at the same time. But there's redemption for the couple at the end of this story, and the colonel eventually can say to his wife, "I'm glad that damned horse fell on me. It made me lie still in one place and look at you." I haven't been reading new short stories very much over the past few years. I guess I've allowed myself to become distracted by the much louder publishing hoopla always generated by novels and book-length works of nonfiction. But Debuse's melancholy collection, Dancing After Hours, reminded me of the peculiar advantage of the short story over other fictional forms. Compressed, intense, a good short story can have the same effect on a reader that the colonel's riding accident had on him. It can make you lie still in one place and look, really look, at a single character or a state of mind. With a few throwaway exceptions, the stories Debuse has gathered here rivet your attention to the everyday routines of his characters' lives, shot through with loss and random tragedy, and occasionally the rapturous surprise of romantic love. Many of the characters Debuse writes about are, like him, disabled. Even the able-bodied people here suffer moments where their mobility is compromised. Ted Briggs, like the colonel, has problems getting around. His knee was blasted apart in Vietnam. In an ambitious cycle that spans four stories, Debuse takes us through Ted's dating days and his fateful encounter with his future wife, Luann. They meet when her heel snaps off her shoe, rendering her temporarily dependent on Ted's cane. Though Debuse is skilled at conveying states of extreme physical and psychological stress, he also excels at capturing quieter moments of desperation. Here's how Debuse describes Luann's job in an insurance company. Often, Luann felt that her smiles and her feigned interest in people's anecdotes about commuting and complaints about colds were an implicit and draining part of her job. A decade later, she would know that spending time with people and being unable either to speak from her heart or listen with it was an imperceptible bleeding of her spirit. The title story, Dancing After Hours, is a haunting piece about a 40-year-old bartender who fends off her constant, low-grade sorrow by imposing on herself iron-bound daily rituals of eating, exercising, and cleaning. One night, a quadriplegic is wheeled into the bar, and in talking with him, our cautious heroine wakes up to the fact that her life is much more circumscribed than his. What saves this story from degenerating into what a disabled acquaintance of mine once called a magical gimp tale is the raw particularity with which Debuse describes the quadriplegic man's lack of control over his own body. He's as repellent to the bartender as he is inspirational. Years ago, I read some of Andre Debuse's stories and resolved to read more. I'll get to them, I'd say periodically, one of these days. One of these days. Like Proust's Madeleine, the terrible accident that befell André Debuse and the wrenching art he's crafted in its wake remind us of the preciousness and finitude of time.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed André Debuse's new collection of short stories, Dancing After Hours. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have a 1991 interview with Debuse in which he talked about the accident that crippled him. One summer night in 1986, he was driving along a highway near Boston when he spotted a woman standing beside her car, which was stopped in the third lane. He pulled off the side of the road to see if anyone was hurt. The woman was bleeding and crying. She and her brother had hit a motorcycle. As the three tried to flag down more help, they were struck by an oncoming car. The brother was killed. The sister was uninjured. Debuse lost one leg and all use of the other. When we spoke 5 years ago, a collection of old and new personal essays called Broken Vessels had just been published. I asked Debuse to read from the opening of a piece about the accident called Lights of the Long Night.
I remember the headlights, but I do not remember the car hitting Luis Santiago and me, and I do not remember the sounds our bodies made. Luis died, either in the ambulance or later that night in the hospital. He was 23 years old. I do not remember leaving the ground my two legs stood on for the last instant in my life, then moving through the air over the car's hood and windshield and roof and falling on his trunk. I remember lying on my back on that trunk and asking someone what happened. I did not lose consciousness. The car did not injure my head or my neck or my spine. It broke my right hand and scraped both arms near my wrists, so my wife believes I covered my face with my arms as I fell. I lay for a while on the trunk talking to a young man, then to a woman who is a state trooper. Then I was in an ambulance, stopped on the highway, talking to a state trooper, a man, while he cut my trousers and my right western boot. That morning, my wife saw the left boot on the side of the highway while she was driving home from the hospital in Boston. The car had knocked it off my foot. The state troopers got the boot from my wife, but I did not leave the hospital with a left foot or, below the middle of my knee, a left leg.
You know, one of the reasons why I asked you to read that story instead of asking you to tell it is that I thought you might feel almost tired of telling the story about what happened to you.
I am.
Are you?
You know, 5 years I've been telling that story. Actually, I don't know if I ever, well, you know, in the first few years it used to scare me and I had to take a Xanax to tell it. And now.
It used to scare you just to tell a story?
Yeah.
And have you told it enough so that it's just a story now? I mean,
actually, I told it to some teenage girls I was teaching. This was only last fall. Ooh. I had a new girl that night. She asked what happened, and another girl started telling her because I didn't want to. But the other girl wasn't telling it right, so I told it. I said, you know, they left. I started to pay bills, and I started getting very anxious, and I wondered what was wrong. And then I thought, well, you've just told a story about almost getting killed and told it at night, which I usually try to avoid doing, and it's messed you up.
Why is it harder to tell it at night?
Oh, I think it has to do with darkness and death. When I got home from the hospital in 86 in September, I got frightened every day at sunset and took a Xanax when the sun went down. And always assumed, no one's told me any different, that because I almost died. And I didn't like seeing the sun go down. And to this day, I sleep with my bedroom door open and all the shades up, because that not being, being closed in reminds me of the hospital where there were windows, but you know, they looked out over an alley. So, I mean, you know, there was window looking onto brick without much light.
Right.
I think so. I mean, you know, I was close.
This is the story of the moment that's probably most changed your life. Mm-hmm. And it's probably the story you've told the most, at least in the past few years. And I'm wondering how the telling of the story has changed over time.
It hasn't really changed much. Since writing that, I've come to terms with the lives of the other people involved. In other words, I've done some forgiving, which was necessary, especially of the driver who ran over us. And, of course, she should be forgiven. It was only an accident, but, you know, I took it personally for about 8 or 9 months. But basically, the story hasn't changed. But as I get now nearly 5 years from it, I'm even more deeply grateful and awed, because I've heard since then of so many other accidents. Grateful and awed that I was struck by a fast-moving vehicle on a highway and emerged as healthy as I did. I mean, you know, I should be dead.
So when you met the driver...
No, I never...
You never met the driver?
No, I never met her. I was brought up in Catholic school, so I learned as a little boy, you know, to pray for people you don't like. And I started doing that for her, using her name, because I really felt hatred, and I knew the only way to get rid of it was praying. And I never felt good about it when I was praying, but finally, after a few months... with some help from somebody else who was actually praying with me, I saw it from the woman's point of view.
In asking you about the telling of the story and how you tell it and how the telling has changed, I think one of the things I'm trying to find out is if you've tried to find a way of telling the story so that what people feel isn't pity but a larger sense of the fragility of life. Do you know what I mean? Like... there's ways of telling stories so that people feel sorry for you, and there's other ways of telling it so that they feel something larger than that.
Every time I tell it to somebody, it's always with awe and gratitude. I've met a lot of injured people since my injury because of the mutual help that we go for. And everyone I know who's crippled has used the word gratitude and grateful, because what happened to us was bad enough to have made things worse, you know. So that's always the way I remember it. Well, I remember it with fear, too. And I never lost consciousness. A nurse told me no one ever remembers the point of impact, but I know two injured people who do, and I'm hoping that I never remember that.
Yeah, don't you think it's a blessing to not
remember? Oh, I think it's
that?
A great blessing. I remember the headlights, and then I remember being on her trunk and then learning that I never lost consciousness. So my eyes must have seen, you know, that grill and hood and windshield coming, and I'm just very glad I don't remember that.
My guest is writer Andre Debuse. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Andre Debuse has a new collection of short stories called Dancing After Hours. We're featuring a 1991 interview with him. Now, you're a very literary man. I mean, you read a lot, you write a lot. And we know all about tragedy and the way people react to, you know, horrible things in their lives from literature, but that doesn't stop us from having to experience it when it happens to us. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
it doesn't save you from anything. Did you feel that, like, what you knew from literature, from, like, the greatest writing that you'd read helped you in any way?
Oh, yes, I do. I do. I think if I had been younger and had a different background, I may have had a worse response, or even older with a different background. Growing up with in Christian Brothers schools, as I did, which were Catholic schools, growing up with the Passion of Christ as your example of this is how things are going to be, gives you the expectation of suffering. And then, you know, I started reading serious literature when I was about 18, and most of that is about what? People who love each other, people who hurt each other, people who lose. And so you could say I've been spending most of my spiritual and mental life dealing with suffering of others, from Christ to Natasha in War and Peace, right?
Has your reading changed in recent years?
Has my reading changed? Yeah. I tend to read more of the New Testament and less of anything else. The first year of my injury, I didn't notice it until someone said to me, "What are you reading?" And I said, "I'm only reading the New Testament and histories of Marines." And the guy said, "Well, that makes sense." And then I realized I was doing both for my spirit, trying to get courage, endurance, grace, patience. I needed that spirit. It became very important to me after I got run over.
You've talked about forgiveness, and of course, you know, there's a lot about forgiveness in the New Testament. How long did it take you to forgive the person who ran you down?
From July until the following May.
You're laughing in a way that's really not a very long time at all, you know.
No,
people can go through
not
a lifetime without that kind of forgiveness.
That was pretty long. And, you know, I had... Well, I'm also laughing because my anger wasn't really rooted in anything reasonable. I thought she should have sent me flowers or a card in the hospital, you know. But I'm sure her attorney, being what they are, said, you know, don't even lick a postage stamp with his name in your mind, or else you're going to get messed up. And After some months, really only through prayer, and I don't want to sound like, you know, some freak, this is just very normal prayers. I mentioned her name every morning and prayed for her because I knew that, you know, I couldn't go around hating somebody. It's just, it destroys you. You can't carry that around in your heart. And, you know, finally the grace came to me to be in the car as she would have been on that night driving. And then I realized, you know, she didn't do anything wrong. She had a bad night. You know, and she didn't do anything wrong either. She wasn't drinking. She wasn't on drugs. She just didn't see us. And it was a, you know, she didn't break any laws. There was never anything done to her.
How long did it take you to start writing again after the accident?
Oof. I'm still working on that. I have been writing. I wrote 10 of those essays. I've written 4 stories. I got hit in July. I wrote a very short story in January. I was trying to write in the hospital. So I've always been writing since the accident. But it's been very difficult to create something whole. On Thanksgiving of 86, Tobias Wolff, that wonderful, wonderful writer and friend, phoned me. I was still in a cast. I was home. I was hurting. And as soon as he said, "This is Toby," I started crying. I said, "Toby, I can't write. Why can't I write?" You know, this was 3-4 months after I got run over. He said, "Because your body's broken and your body and spirit are one, and they're both mending." And I think that's been going on for a long time. I mean, you know, I still have aches and pains and fatigue every day, but I think a new gift is coming. I really do. I think writing is going to become more what it was before I got run over than what it's been since I got run over, which has been like, you know, chasing a blowing piece of paper on a windy playground.
Well, one of the new pieces in your new collection, in one of those pieces you say that the best person for a crippled man to cry with is a good physical therapist. Have you gotten a new sense of what's best to bring to or to leave to a professional, you know, as opposed to someone who you're very intimate with, someone in your family?
I went to a professional psychologist in 89, which was nearly 3 years after the accident, because I woke up every morning crying, and one morning I couldn't stop. And so I guess I learned from that, you know, when you can't move, it's time to go to the professionals. What the professional did in 1 hour, though, was get me to contact 2 other crippled friends, and one came over 2 days later, taught me to drive a car. And so I saw this guy, the professional, probably for about 6 or 8 weeks. And, he was very good. He said, "You're not depressed. You're sad because you lost your legs, and you'll always be sad, and you'll never replace them," which is exactly what all the friends I called said. You know, you will always wake up missing your legs, and you will never get over that. And I had made the mistake of expecting one day to wake up as you do from the flu and say, "Wow, that was tough. Now I feel great. I'm myself again." And it never happened. So before I, just lay there crying for a few days, I used to call myself a bad cripple. I was angry at myself for not being a cheerful cripple. Then I found out from the other guys who were more experienced cripples than I that they weren't cheerful either. They had just learned to expect to wake up feeling this, and they and expect to go through this each day and night, you know, the psychic pain, the spiritual, the physical. And it's nice to have that brother and sisterhood.
You use the word cripple to describe your condition?
I do. I do, but I think that's because I'm a writer. I've never liked euphemisms. You know, I don't say passed away. I say dead. One of my older children came to me in the hospital and said, "You're not disabled, you're physically challenged." I said, "No, you're physically challenged. You're breathing hard from climbing the stairs. I'm disabled." My friends who are active disabled people like to be called disabled, so I call them disabled. But cripple is a good old-fashioned word for me, you know. And that's what I would have written before if I write the story about somebody who was crippled.
Andre Debuse, recruited in 1991. Our interview will continue in the second half of our show. Then we'll hear a short conversation we recorded yesterday. Debuse has a new collection of short stories called Dancing After Hours. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The documentary Crumb about underground comic book artist R. Crumb has just come out on home video. We're listening to music from the soundtrack. Coming up, we hear from the film's director, Terry Zweigoff. Also, we continue our 1991 interview with writer Andre Debuse and call him to see how he's doing now. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with writer Andre Debuse about the 1986 car accident that changed his life. He lost one leg and lost all use of the other. It was very hard for him to resume writing after the accident. Now he has a new collection of short stories called Dancing After Hours. Our interview was recorded in 1991.
I don't know. I guess it was a year or two after your accident, you were separated from your third wife.
Mm-hmm.
And
1 year, just about
1 year. And I was wondering if you've thought a lot about whether it was the relationship or the accident that, you know, and how the accident changed the relationship, you know, that was responsible for the separation.
Yeah, I have, but it's not too personal a question. It's just one that I can't answer because I don't have the answers. The thing is about marriage is my own and everybody else's. I always assume there are so many mysteries that I will never understand anybody's any more than they do. So, you know, would we have would we still be married if I hadn't got run over? I don't know. I really don't know. I hope so. I don't know. I know the accident did something. And I know that I've only learned this spring, realized this spring, just thinking back on myself, that I was a little crazy for at least a year, but I think most of two. And still am. Things get distorted when you've been on your legs for nearly 50 years, and then all of a sudden you're sitting, you're always looking up at people, steps are always problems, bathrooms are always problems, traveling is horrendous, it's frightening, it's stressful, it's helpless, you're always in someone else's hands, the access is never right, the world is not curbs. Well, of course, the world is eating, drinking, sleeping, being clean, emptying one's body waste, and all of that has to do with access, so... But, this can get very boring to listen to, and it's actually been a problem with my writing. I've had a hard time in fiction. I was writing a story last fall about a woman with, a husband and three children, and my notes were to get everybody up in the morning and get breakfast and get that done in one paragraph. I went, Terry... 2,400 words before I got him out of the house. And I read those 2,400 words to my fiction workshop that meets at my house on Thursdays. And as soon as I finished reading it, I said, this is really about somebody in a wheelchair. I didn't know that. But it took me another month or so to realize that I was spending so much time. There were some pretty nice sentences there, too, but it's all madness. I was spending so much time on that story because I celebrated her getting out of bed and putting her boots on while standing up, walking to the bathroom, standing up from the toilet, standing at the lavatory in the mirror, going downstairs, standing at the stove. I mean, it was Ginger Rogers I was doing. I was choreographing. I thought, oh, my God, I've not only lost height perception, I can't tell how tall people are anymore, but I've lost the proper perspective for biped fictional characters.
Well, why not write fiction about somebody who is in a wheelchair, who is crippled? Why not? And why hold yourself back from that if it seems like that's what you're writing anyways?
Because I don't think I'll feel like I've gotten back until I can write something resounding about somebody who has legs. I think this is also the truth. Usually, as a writer, if something has really happened to me, I write about it in an essay. I usually write fiction about things that bother me about the world or fascinate me, but are not really very personal. So if I'm going to put somebody in a wheelchair, I might as well just do an essay.
Let me ask you, is one of the great paradoxes of this accident that the accident has brought more attention to you and your writing, but at the same time it's made it more difficult for you to write?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Well, I want to wish you the best with your health and with your writing and your new book and everything, and I thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you, and I wish the best to you.
Andre Debuse recorded in 1991, 5 years after the accident that crippled him. Now he has a new collection of short stories called Dancing After Hours. Well, we wanted to find out if he's facing the same writing dilemmas that he faced 5 years ago when we spoke, so we got in touch with him yesterday.
Andre Debuse, do you still feel like in your writing you're choreographing the movement of your characters and celebrating their ability to stand on 2 feet and put on their boots?
I still feel like I'm doing that. But I'm not doing it with as many details as I did then. But now I'm happily doing it. I'm thinking of a story called The Lover, in which I, with great excitement, wrote about a man simply walking from his apartment to a coffee shop in the rain. And I don't think I would have written it that way before I lost the ability to walk.
What was different about the way you wrote this? What do you think is in there that wouldn't have been in there before?
It was a joyful thing for me that he was out doing something as simple as walking down to the coffee shop to get some coffee. You lose something you had and you realize sometimes, right, how wonderful it is. Legs are marvelous things, marvelous.
In our previous interview, you said, I had asked you, well, why not write from the perspective of being in a wheelchair, and you seemed really reluctant to do that. You said if you did that, you might as well do an essay. But there's a couple of stories in your new book You know, one character breaks both legs, one character is a quadriplegic. Did you change your attitude about writing from the perspective of somebody who can't walk?
I'll tell you, that's a beautiful question, because it touches on something that is such a blessing in my life. My daughter, Nicole, who lives in California, who's in her 30s, called me 3, 4, 5 years ago when I was having a hard time writing fiction, and I was actually complaining to her about the same thing I complained to you about back in 91. And she said, keep writing essays about being in a wheelchair, and then gradually somebody in a wheelchair would get into a story, and then gradually there would be bipeds in your stories. But she said, right now, your life has changed so much that you cannot see an imaginary world. So just keep doing this. I was working on the story, the first story, which has a wheelchair in it. I was working on The Colonel's Wife, but the man was a biped. And after my daughter Nicole told me that, I had a horse fall on him and broke his legs. And the story moved. And then after that, all the stories moved, and all of them were bipeds until the last one. And that last one is a quadriplegic who's based on a friend I had who was a quadriplegic. I say had because he died. He died before I ever wrote that story.
So you were writing the story about the colonel at the end. You had some kind of change of heart and had a horse fall on him and break his legs?
I took my daughter's advice, and I thought, well, you know, maybe if I put somebody in a wheelchair in a story, maybe this will work. And so he lost his legs for a while, and then the story started working. I cannot explain why this is true, but that is what happened. I won't even try to explain this. But once I broke his legs, the story began to move, and it had never worked. And then after that, other stories started coming, and none of them had wheelchairs in them or anybody crippled until the last one.
Are there other ways that you feel your writing is changing now?
I can only guess. It's more than a guess. I'm sure that more of my characters are grateful for quotidian blessings, for things like breathing, eating a cucumber, because I am. Other than that, I wouldn't know, because I really don't think much about what I've written after I feel that it's done. So, you know, I couldn't answer a question if you asked me to compare the first story I ever wrote with the most recent one, except to say I hope the most recent one is better.
And I've got one other question to ask you. And again, you know, our previous interview was recorded about 4 years ago. Has your mood, your spirit, your feelings about your injury changed in the interim?
Oh yeah, I feel much better about everything. You know, I'm in my 10th year now, and that makes sense. Tenth year since the injury, and you know, it's not an illness. There's not that kind of deterioration, thank God. So I actually feel stronger. I feel I have more energy. I'm more peaceful. You know, I've learned a lot about what I can do, what I can't do, and which places won't allow me to do. And you know, I try to live more slowly and plan ahead more. And yeah, I feel much better. I'd like to put in another 30 years.
Andre Debuse, he has a new collection of short stories called Dancing After Hours. Coming up, the director of the movie Crumb, which just came out on home video. This is Fresh Air. R. Crumb was one of the founders of the underground comics movement in the 1960s and became the most famous of the artists. Crumb, who has always kept out of the public eye, is the subject of the documentary Crumb that was on lots of critics' 1995 10 best lists.
Crumb won the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival, and many critics thought it should have been nominated for an Academy Award. Crumb just came out on home video. Cartoonist R. Crumb's work is twisted, neurotic, and sex-obsessed, and it turns out, so is R. Crumb.
And when I was 13 and 14 and trying to be a normal teenager, I was like really a jerk. I mean, I tried to, you know, act like I thought they were acting. It just came out all wrong and weird. So then I just stopped completely and just became a shadow. And I wasn't even there. No, people weren't even aware that I was, you know, in the same world they were in. And that kind of freed me completely because I wasn't under those pressures to be normal. So I got interested in old-time music and went to the black section of town knocking on doors and looking for old records and things like that that would be unthinkable if you were going to be a normal teenager. This is my image celebrating Valentine's Day, February 13th, 1962. I decided to reject conforming when society rejected me. I've heard all that be yourself stuff. When I'm myself, people think I'm nuts. Guess I'll have to be satisfied with cats and old records. Girls are just utterly out of my reach. They won't even let me draw them. Yeah, all that changed after I got famous.
An excerpt of the movie Crumb. We'll hear from the director, Terry Zwigoff, in a couple of minutes on this archive edition of Fresh Air. First, let's hear what critic Ken Tucker had to say about the documentary when it was first released last spring.
At the start of this extraordinary documentary, we see Robert Crumb lecturing to a group of scruffy art students in Philadelphia. He shows them slides of some of his best-known images, the cover of Big Brother and the Holding Company's 1968 album Cheap Thrills, a drawing of his lewd feline character Fritz the Cat, and the cartoon that became a kind of hippie talisman, Keep on Truckin'. Crumb explains that he's showing them this stuff to jog their memories, to establish a connection with the students who might not otherwise know who he is. And then Crumb proceeds to badmouth all three of these famous works of his, heaping contempt on the pop culture industry that made those images pervasive, and expressing equal contempt for himself, for what he perceives as selling out to greedy hacks. He's even not too proud to reveal how little he made for the drawing of that famous cover of Janis Joplin's multi-million-selling album, a measly $600. What comes across in this opening scene is the cranky, contradictory public persona that Crumb has created for himself. The most famous underground cartoonist of the 60s who has always hated the counterculture. The sex-crazy weirdo who lives a calm bourgeois life with his wife and daughter. The artist who helped destroy distinctions between high art and low, but whose own aesthetics are deeply reactionary. As portrait of the artist stuff, the movie Crumb is beautifully lucid. There are sharp comments from the critic Robert Hughes that place Crumb in an art historical context. There are scenes of Crumb fondling women's backsides for a photo shoot for a porno magazine that place Crumb in a psychopathological context. And some lovely quiet scenes of Crumb sketching in his notebook. But then the movie goes much deeper as it reveals its true intention, which is to place Robert Crumb in the context of his family. A family so profoundly troubled that the fashionable term of the moment, dysfunctional, seems pathetically superficial. Director Terry Zwigoff interviews Robert's older brother Charles and his younger brother Max. Neither of them lives in the real world. Charles, an articulate, witty man, seems to be in a perpetual state of nervous breakdown. He hasn't left his mother's house in years, reads the same 19th century philosophy text over and over, and freely admits that he really ought to bathe more often. Yet when this sweaty recluse was a boy, he was also a very talented cartoonist, and the person that got Robert interested in being an artist. Max, on the other hand, is a mystic, too troubled to be blissed out. His only apparent source of income comes from begging on the street while sitting on a bed of nails. Robert seems fully aware of how odd his siblings are. He sees many aspects of himself in them. He grins and laughs very nervously as he blames it all on his late father. All three brothers believe that Dad's tyrannical bullying managed to produce these intensely repressed, introverted men. To a great extent, Robert Crumb's contempt for his audience, whom he feels have both undervalued and misunderstood him, enables this movie to be the revelation it is. Zwigoff was free to explore the profound misogyny and self-loathing in Crumb's work because the artist doesn't care what we end up thinking about him. By the end of the film, Crumb has traded three notebooks of drawings for a house in France, and this American genius who despises America is shown packing up his beloved old jazz records and his equally beloved wife and child, and bidding the U.S. good riddance. just as the intricately detailed ugliness of Robert Crumb's drawing can be tremendously moving, so does this film biography make Crumb's crabbed, obsessive life seem like a pure triumph.
Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic. He writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Crumb has just come out on home video. Terry Zwigoff directed the film. He's been a friend of R. Crumb's for over 25 years. Zwigoff says he first thought of making this film back in 1974 when he met R. Crumb's reclusive older brother, Charles. R. Crumb credits Charles with getting him and the whole family interested in comics. Zwigoff looked beyond Charles's eccentricity and saw brilliance and wit. I spoke with him, with Zwigoff, last April about his documentary, Crumb. I think what I find fascinating about your film is that it raises a lot of questions about madness and genius. I mean, both R. Crumb and his older brother, Charles, are not what we'd call normal. They're both incredibly talented, but it seems that Charles didn't have the energy or the will to actually work, whereas R. Crumb had the drive. In fact, he was obsessive about his work. Did you find yourself thinking a lot during the making of this movie about that combination of madness and genius?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I had read a book called Touched with Fire. Forget the woman that wrote it.
Oh, that's a book about manic depressives.
Yeah,
who were
and the
artists.
Correlation between manic depressive illness and creativity. It was a really interesting book. Ran down all these figures in history, famous artists and writers like Melville and Poe and Byron, and how they all had this incredibly high rate of either suicide or being institutionalized. And I don't know. In general, you know, I find most art, whether it's film or painting, anything that stems out of suffering by the artist is generally what I'm attracted to, you know. Like my favorite films are by, you know, people like Scorsese, who, you know, I don't know, he's probably pretty well adjusted now after all his success. But I'm sure when he started out, he's probably a very bitter, twisted guy, and he made very interesting films. He still does, to his credit. But he makes films you don't usually see in Hollywood, you know, films about losers and loners and the disenfranchised, and that's always been of interest to me.
Your film, Crumb, opens with R. Crumb on the telephone calling up his brother, saying that you want to come over and shoot some scenes there, that you want Charles in the movie.
Right.
And Charles apparently doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to be in the film. What made him change his mind?
Well, what really happened is when I started this film about 1985, I told Robert when he finally agreed to do it that I had no interest in making it unless his brother Charles and his mother and his brother Max and agreed to be in it. And so he said, well, all right, well, let me call my mother and see if she'll do it, because she's probably going to say no. But he called her and she remembered me, and I had actually hit it off with her pretty good, as I really liked her, and I thought the feeling was mutual when I met her, and ditto with Charles. And they both said yes at the time on the phone. So I told him to tell her that, you know, it would take me a couple months to get it ready, but in a couple months we'd come out their way with a small film crew, and I'd like to spend 4 days at their house filming them. She said okay. We kept her posted on the dates, and then when we arrived at that motel, you see that scene in the film where he calls her and she says no. She had just completely changed her mind, and I was sort of devastated and you know, rather shocked. But I spent the next 4 days with the crew sitting around the motel trying to convince her to change her mind back to agree to do the film, and eventually I was able to.
R. Crumb's older brother Charles committed suicide shortly after your film was completed. Do you know what happened that put him over the edge?
No, I don't. I don't know what happened at all.
Did you ever worry at all that him being exposed in the film might have upset him or anything?
I worried very much, and I had a long talk with Robert about that very subject, whether this film in some way could have contributed to that happening. And I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. You know, Robert's opinion was no, that he tried to kill himself a number of times, and, you know, I was worried that possibly that talking about some of these childhood family issues had sort of precipitated things. But then again, when I first met Charles in the early 70s, that's, you know, he talked about exactly the same stuff. So I don't know, it's something I have to sort of deal with for the rest of my life. If it did have anything to do with it, I would feel extremely bad.
My guest is Terry Zwigoff, director of the documentary Crumb. It just came out on video. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Back with Terry Zweigoff, director of Crumb, a documentary about the underground cartoonist R. Crumb.
You're obviously really absorbed in R. Crumb's family, and it's a family of very unusual people. Crumb's younger brother is into some kind of unusual approaches to meditation and so on. I mean, he lies on a bed of nails and swallows something that looks like a fabric tapeworm. His mother is very overweight and doesn't seem to even have the strength or the will to sit up on the couch. But you're not parading them as a family of freaks. You seem to just be riveted by them, by their attitude toward life, by what they have to say. What fascinates you about the family and the relationships of the people in it?
I liked his family very much. I when I met them, I felt very close to them. I can't explain why. I felt a deep bond with his family. And I was a little, you know, I've been a little horrified to see now and then in the press somebody describes the family as, you know, in a rather insensitive way, like you were referring to. And I never saw them as that, you know. I always found those very brilliant people, and yeah, a little eccentric, but I really thought they had, I thought they're incredibly interesting to talk to and incredibly funny, and you get to know these people, you find they're very interesting, very likable people.
R. Crumb the cartoonist and R. Crumb the man are both sexually obsessed. How did you decide about how you wanted to deal with that in the film?
Well, it was never, you know, I tried in this film to emulate Robert in a sense, in the way he works, and that he sort of goes with his instincts and just sort of tries not to plan, you know, what direction you're going in and trust your instincts and see where that's going to get you. And sometimes you wind up in a dead end and somewhat embarrassed and make a big mistake. And sometimes it's very, very much of a, you get a great payoff out of that. And I never thought about it too much. I just tried to instinctually sort of go along and decide, where's this taking me? Where's this going? What should I, you know, go to next? And it seemed like the two things motivating his art the most and actually fueling him as an artist the most were sex and anger. And, you know, I chose some of his work to show that definitely dealt with both those issues.
You've been Crumb's friend for a long time. Was he ever embarrassing to be around? Did he ever do anything that was very embarrassing to you?
I was driving him somewhere in my car in San Francisco years ago, and this is the first time I really realized how sexually twisted he was and how obsessed. We're driving down the street, and he saw this woman. Well, I didn't know he saw a woman. I just noticed that he was sort of craning around in his seat and sticking his head out the window to try to see what we had just passed. And he was incredibly animated about it, just going crazy. I said, "What? What?" And I turn around, and there was this woman who was walking down the street who was, I don't know what the correct word is, but, you know, a pinhead, had a very small head.
Mm-hmm.
And he was incredibly excited over her, incredibly excited, just, you know, thought that was the most attractive thing he'd ever seen on a woman. I thought, God, that's pretty strange, pretty strange.
Did he whistle or anything?
No, he was upset for the rest of the day. He was depressed for the rest of the day because he lusted after her so much, he knew he'd never be able to meet her.
I find it very hard to interview friends because when you're interviewing somebody, you really want them to reveal things. When you're interviewing a friend, you know their strengths and weaknesses. You want to protect their weaknesses.
Them, yeah.
And if they tell you things that are very personal, you almost want to say, are you sure you want to say that on tape? You know,
there are many things I left on the editing room floor in this film.
To protect Crumb?
Well, to protect his family, certainly. There were a lot of things said, say, by Charles, you know, or his mother that I just thought are nobody's business and has no relevance in this film.
It must have been hard, though, for you to figure out where that line ought to be.
People always said, you know, how can you do that? It's such a thin line to tread. I never had a problem with that. I felt very decided one way or another immediately when something, you know, I looked at something in the editing room, whether this was appropriate or not. It always seemed very easy for me to make that choice. I don't know why. Other things were certainly a lot harder.
Now, did Crumb's comics mean a lot to you?
I liked his work a lot. You know, I'd seen it in college and read it and always enjoyed it. I always thought he was a really great cartoonist, but it never, you know, I didn't really think he was a great artist until much later, until I got to know him. I hung out with him for a while, and he actually changed the way that I see the world.
How so?
Well, the one incident I can remember is coming home from work one day, and he had a key to my house. He was staying at my house for a week, and he had lost the key, and he was locked out. And to pass the time, He was drawing a sketch of this house across the street from me up on the corner. This house that I'd seen, you know, 10,000 times since I'd lived there. And I looked at the sketch he did, and I looked back at the house. I never saw that same scene the same again. He had slightly exaggerated the number of overhead telephone wires and electrical junction boxes and all that junk, you know. And that stuff had always been invisible to me. And that's all he sees in the world, you know. He's almost like this person from another planet, you know. He's always looking for a weakness or something critical to get at, you know. And it's very informative hanging out with the guy. I can't say I'm a happier person from the way I feel much more aware, though, of what's going on in the world.
Terry Zwigoff directed the documentary Crumb, which has just come out on home video. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Kathy Wolf. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. And we say thanks to our intern, Nate Hardy, who returns to his high school classes on Monday. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.